Hello and welcome to This Week I Learned, your audio guide to the most surprising discoveries and fascinating studies of the week. I'm your host, Lauren Hansen. This week I learned that praying mantises are coming for your hummingbirds. The praying mantis is named for the way its prominent front legs bend together near its face in a prayer-like fashion. But don't be fooled by that passive-looking pose. The praying mantis is one of the most cunning and vicious of nature's predators. It's the only insect in the world that can swivel its head from side to side, looking over its shoulder in a creepily human way. It walks slowly and deliberately so it can sneak up on its unsuspecting prey. When it's ready, it strikes, moving its preyful front legs twice as fast as we can blink. What it wants is inside, and so it attacks while the victim still squirms beneath its grasp. It goes in through the eye or other cavities to get to that nutrient-rich innards. The praying mantis prefers cockroaches and flies, but they're not against cannibalism. If they're mid-meal and another praying mantis approaches, they'll usually go head-to-head with the winner eating the loser. When praying mantises are born, if they can't find food, they'll often eat their brothers and sisters. They don't necessarily shy away from larger prey, either. They've been known to feast on the occasional small vertebrae like frogs, lizards, small turtles, and birds. But when zoologists from Switzerland tracked the eating habits of praying mantises over time and across the globe, they were surprised by just how many birds the bugs were feasting on. It turns out dining on birds isn't as rare as they once thought. Reviewing all available scientific literature and accounts of bird predation by mantises, the researchers discovered that the phenomenon had been documented in 13 different countries. All told, there were 147 reported cases of praying mantises killing birds, which isn't exactly a threat, but it was alarming. The majority of the cases occurred in the U.S., with the diminutive hummingbird being the prime target. What the praying mantis does is it targets the hummingbird at feeders. While a bird is eating, the praying mantis strikes from above, trapping the bird head in its barbed grip. The mantis is equipped with several different mouth parts designed to slice, rip, grind, and suck at its prey until they get what they want. And that's pretty much what they're doing to that poor hummingbird. They go for the brain, and they'll enter the bird's eyes or mouth cavity to get it. When it's done, it might just decapitate the bird before moving on. Now, experts aren't too concerned that praying mantises are going to be the end of the American hummingbird population. But since these insects are actually often used in gardens to eat unwanted pests, or even kept as pets, researchers warn against letting them out into the wild willy-nilly. Because while you might be hoping that your praying mantis will nip your beetle infestation, they might just have their little beady eyes set on something a little bit larger. This week I learned how frogs are able to catch prey with their tongues faster than you or I can blink. A frog tongue is a delightfully gross natural phenomenon. Not only can it catch prey at a speed unmatched by anything we humans have made ourselves, but that sticky pad isn't limited to insects. Some frog species can catch mice and even the passing bird with their whip-fast tongues. And what's crazy is that this weapon of theirs is ridiculously soft, like as soft as brain tissue, or 10 times softer than our tongues. But that softness is all part of the trap. It all comes down to the physical properties of the tongue and the chemical properties of the saliva. Frog saliva is different from humans in that it has higher concentrations of long-chain proteins, which is what makes it thicker and more snot-like than our spit. Having lower concentrations of these proteins like we do is what makes our saliva drippy rather than gloppy. It's why when babies drool, these long strings of saliva can drip down before dropping off. But what's also cool about a frog's saliva and what makes it different from ours is that it has transformative abilities. A study published in the Journal of Royal Society Interface in February found that frog saliva is a non-Newtonian liquid. And now for a quick primer on Isaac Newton's law of viscosity. According to Isaac Newton's law of viscosity, there are two kinds of liquids, normal liquid and strange liquid. Normal liquids have a constant viscosity, meaning their flow behavior does what it's supposed to do unless it comes across changes in temperature. So, like water, for example, is a normal liquid. It fills a cup, runs through your hands, and doesn't resist to outside stress. If you hit water with your hand, the flow stays the same. But those strange liquids? Well, their flows are not constant. What makes these liquids different is that they react to stress, changing their flow when hit or stirred or shaken. Sometimes that stress will thin the liquid out, and sometimes it'll thicken right up. Think of solid honey. The more you stir it, the thinner and more liquidy it becomes. Tomato sauce in a jar, however, give it a couple taps on the side and it tends to thin a bit and more easily pour out. Or cream is another good example. When you whip cream over a period of time, it thickens. This morphing effect is what happens to a frog's saliva. When the saliva is sitting in the frog's mouth, it's thick and almost snotty. But when it exerts force, sending the tongue out to catch a fly, it thins out to a more watery substance so that the saliva can fill all the insect's crevices. Then when it yanks the tongue back in, the saliva reverses to that thick consistency, trapping the bug for that speedy return to the mouth for dinner. This week I learned the evolutionary reason why we sleep less as we age. I have talked a lot about the science of sleep on this podcast. It fascinates me, probably because it vexes me. I previously learned, for example, the neuroscience behind age-related sleeplessness. Researchers studying mice believe that as we age, our brains stop getting the signal that we're tired. We keep sending out the same sleepiness cues, but the receptors in the brain that receive those cues fade over time. But researchers now have some clues to the evolutionary reason behind this age-related insomnia. It turns out that not being able to sleep when you're older may have helped us survive in the wild. Centuries ago, we slept basically out in the open, but we did so in groups. And there was this theory that through evolution, we developed different chronotypes, those individual differences in the way we tend to sleep. Like how teenagers go to bed later and get up later, and older people go to bed early and get up earlier. And these chronotypes naturally help the groups of our early ancestors survive the night against the elements. It's an interesting theory, but scientists have never been able to test it on humans until now. Researchers from the University of Toronto were able to study the Hadza, a group of hunter-gatherers in northern Tanzania. The Hadza sleep in grass huts, which each have about one or two adults and several children. But they live in these camps of about 30 adults, and there are often several camps close by. Volunteers from the Hadza had their sleep tracked with motion sensors for about 20 days. And what researchers found was that hardly anyone slept in sync. At least one person was either awake or sleeping lightly and could easily be woken up. And the variation in sleep time was almost entirely accounted for by the mixture of ages in the group that was studied. So there's this other theory about grandparents and their evolutionary purpose. Not to be harsh, I love my grandparents, but if you're past reproductive age, you don't really have any evolutionary reason to be hanging around. But researchers long believed that because grandparents helped care for grandkids, that they proved to be necessary well beyond their reproductive years. This is known as the grandparent hypothesis. But this new study suggests yet another group advantage to having Gigi and Papa around, that a mixed age demographic increases the necessary awareness, or that night watchman behavior, within the group. It's what these scientists are dubbing the poorly sleeping grandparent hypothesis. This week I learned that corals that live deep in the ocean create their own sunlight to survive. Over the millennia, coral have developed this symbiotic relationship with algae. Coral give the algae shelter, and in return, the algae convert light into food. And this kind of photosynthesis makes up something like 90% of the coral's nutrients. But for coral that lives near the surface, that necessary sunlight can be too much for the little algae. So the coral help the algae out here too. According to the New York Times, the coral has proteins deep inside its tissue that use the sun's ultraviolet light to glow a greenish hue that protects the algae like sunscreen. But there's something about coral that has always puzzled scientists. There are also coral that live way, way deep down in the water's depths. And these coral also glow like their surface-dwelling counterparts. It's not like they need the sun protection, so what's the deal? It turns out coral are glowing for the exact opposite reason, to create light. Those little proteins hiding inside the coral's tissue soak up what little blue light exists several hundred feet below the surface, and then they shine it back out into this magnificent hue of orange or red. Then the coral's algae is able to take this coral-produced light and turn it back into food. And that does it for this episode of This Week I Learned. Look out for new episodes of Free Friday on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you'd like to read more about any of the facts I've mentioned, you can go to theweek.com/podcasts, where you'll find a link to the most insane photo of a praying mantis eating a hummingbird. You'll also find The Week's other audio series, 7-Minute Opinions and 7-Minute Explainers. And as a thank you for listening to this episode, we'd like to offer you 4 risk-free issues of The Week magazine. To get those, visit theweek.com/4free. I'm Lauren Hansen, and thank you so much for listening.